This is the Quality News Network. Israel and Hezbollah are trading missile attacks following yesterday's kidnapping of two Israeli soldiers along the Israeli-Lebanese border. So far, Israeli airstrikes have hit hundreds of targets, including several Lebanese military airfields, the runways at Beirut's international airport forcing its closure. Its navy has blockaded Lebanese ports, and more than 50 people have been killed. Hezbollah has responded by firing missiles into northern Israel. President Bush says Israel has a right to defend itself, but he also says it should be careful that in its effort to attack Hezbollah, it does not weaken the fragile Lebanese government, which has no control over the militant organization. The violence between Israel and Lebanon is the worst in a decade and coincides with a major offensive by Israel in the Gaza Strip, which also began as an attempt to free a kidnapped Israeli soldier. Senate Judiciary Chairman Arlen Specter says that the White House has agreed to allow a secret federal court, the FISA court, to review the National Security Agency's domestic spying program. North Korea walked out of talks with South Korea today, talks about the missile crisis, prompting Seoul to immediately freeze food aid to Pyongyang. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council is expected to vote this weekend on proposals urging North Korea to suspend its nuclear program. Authorities in India have detained as many as 350 people in connection with Tuesday's bombings on Mumbai commuter trains, which killed nearly 200 people and wounded 700 more. Coalition forces in Iraq have handed over control of an entire province in southern Iraq to Iraqi forces. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki says it's an important step towards the goal of having all 18 provinces under Iraqi responsibility by the end of next year. Still, the violence continues. 18 people killed in attacks throughout the country today. Tehran is warning that it could halt UN inspections and quit the nuclear nonproliferation treaty if pressure increases over its disputed nuclear program. A Southern California wildfire near Yucca Valley that has already consumed 37,000 acres is now edging towards the San Bernardino National Forest. Fire officials worry that if it gets there, the fire will then grow very quickly and could endanger the resort community of Big Bear Lake. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan welcoming a U.S. military order to apply basic provisions of the Geneva Conventions to detainees at Guantanamo Bay. And the surgeon treating Kentucky Derby winner Barbaro, who broke his leg during the Preakness Stakes, now says his chances for survival are poor now that the colt has developed a severe case of a disease brought on by uneven weight distribution in his legs. You're listening to the Quality News Network. Business news is coming up. It's now 2.5 minutes past the hour.
In addition to producing and distributing the finest hourly newscasts in the country, the Quality News Network conducts interviews with 2006 candidates. We afford congressional and gubernatorial challengers of every political stripe the opportunity to illuminate their views and to demonstrate their character in a 20-minute network quality interview. We perform this public service to enable voters to get a better listen to the people they might consider electing to high office. Because as Thomas Jefferson said, if a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. If you want to know more about who is running in the November elections, go to qualitynewsnetwork.com and click on 2006 candidates. If we are to get America back on track, we need to elect people who can lead us in the right direction. Now, back to the news.
New claims for unemployment benefits jumped last week to 332,000. That's an increase of 19,000 claims. Economists had forecast that jobless claims would rise by only 7,000. PepsiCo has posted a better-than-expected 14% rise in second-quarter profit, helped by its non-soda portfolio, including Gatorade sports drinks and Aquafina water. Walmart has announced a change in policy, says that from now on it will only prosecute shoplifters who take more than $25 worth of merchandise. Three former British bankers are en route from London to Houston to face fraud charges relating to the collapse of Enron. The extradition of the three is the first high-profile case under a new extradition treaty between Britain and the U.S., which has been enforced since January of 2004 and was designed to speed up the extradition of terrorists. The FDA has approved a combination pill for people infected with the AIDS virus. The daily pill, which includes three FDA-approved medicines already used for HIV and AIDS, is called Atripla, and will cost more than $1,100 for a month's supply. And Microsoft says that a European Union fine against it for $357 million will not affect the launch of Windows Vista, its next-generation operating system, which is expected to be out by January. Lightsweet crude oil is in record territory right now, $76.35 a barrel. That's up $1.40 from yesterday. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrial is down 79 points, below 11,000 now. NASDAQ is down 10, and the S&P 500 is down 5. More at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Diana Walter.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. You know, one of the differences between the right and the left of the political spectrum, between conservatives and liberals, is that we liberals don't always agree on things. I think the conservative movement works very hard to enforce a certain agreement among its various parties. The religious right supports corporations that are mistreating the poor because the religious right wants to see the government become a theocracy and to install its religion among us all. And people, CEOs, people who want to make money off the backs of the poor and mistreat American workers and so forth, don't really care so much about making America a theocratic state, but they tend to support the religious right because they know that their allies are all together. Well, we liberals are different. We tend to be fairly true to our principles and to defend them fiercely. And, well, heck, as Will Rogers once said, I'm not a member of any organized party. I'm a Democrat. So I fully understand that liberals sometimes disagree, and I want to encourage you, wherever you are in the political spectrum, to call in and disagree with me. Or you can always call in and agree, too. That's certainly fine. But don't be afraid about calling in and disagreeing. Yesterday, if you heard the end of my broadcast, I had a very interesting talk with Rama from Vermont. I don't know if Rama is still listening or got so angered by my response that he doesn't want to listen anymore. But the problem was that the call occurred right at the end of my broadcast, when we only had about 6 minutes left, and there really wasn't enough time, I know, for him or I to have a full exchange of views. So I want to encourage him or anyone else that wants to call in as early as possible, and I assure you, you will get what you want to say out on air. If you call during the last 5 minutes, I may not be able to give you as much time as you'd like, so that's just a general warning. So I'll give out the phone number as we go, 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. I also want to give a shout-out to Bob Kincaid. He is the head producer, he's everyone at Head On Radio Network, him and his wife, Agnes, Annie. The two of them have done a tremendous job. He's the one who got me on the Head On Radio Network, and he's got a show, in fact, on every day that you should check out at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, a terrific show. He's a great guy from West Virginia. You really should listen in. But the reason I'm giving him a shout-out is because I like the fact that he lets me say what I want on air. I can't tell you how much that means to me. I was on a left radio network. Some of you may have heard of it, Radio Power. And the person there in charge of that network tried to censor me again and again and again. She didn't like when I said certain things on the right. She didn't like when I said certain things on the left. And it got so bad that I had to leave that network. I've also been asked, I should let you know, by no fewer than six different large syndicated radio networks, that if I would just moderate my anti-Bush rhetoric, if I wouldn't call myself a liberal, if I wouldn't call myself a Democrat, if I'd call myself a moderate or an independent, oh, they really like my show. They'll put me on the air. Just don't bash Bush. And I was saying, I have to be true to myself. So a real shout out to Bob Kincaid, who lets me say what I want on the air. I really appreciate that. And with that being said, I'm about to take a very strong stand on the war in the Middle East, because I support the war in the Middle East. I think when a country declares war on you, you have the right, duty, and obligation to do self-defense, which is why I and virtually everyone I know there are a few on the far left that disagree, but 99% of Americans, we supported the war in Afghanistan. They attacked us. The Taliban and its organ, Al-Qaeda, attacked us. They murdered 3,000 Americans. And I remember clear as a bell, as I'm sure you do, exactly where you were on September 11, 2001. I remember where I was. I was sitting in a house office building, at the Rayburn House Office Building, which connects, by the way, via tunnel to the Capitol. The Capitol, which very likely would have been hit if it were not for some American heroes in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, over the skies there. I could have been hit. I mean, they could have hit that Capitol. The fire could have gone through. I probably would not have been, but certainly a bunch of my friends were. I can't imagine the Capitol dome destroyed. But I remember how I felt that day. And some people told me they felt shock. Some people have told me they felt sadness overwhelming sadness for the thousands of Americans who died, and I did feel that over the ensuing week. But that day, I have to admit, I was angry. I was ready for war. I was ready for a congressional declaration of war, because you know me, I like to do things by the book, by the Constitution. I was ready to fight back, to defend my country, the United States of America, against whoever were the evil demons who murdered 3,000 innocent people. Well, I don't have quite as strong feeling as I did on September 11th. I admit that. It wasn't my country being attacked. But I must admit, when Israel was attacked, I felt strongly they needed to defend themselves. Let's talk about what happened, not just in Gaza, but specifically what's going on in Lebanon right now. I want to give you the details. And like I said, if you disagree with me, don't hesitate to pick up the phone and call in and tell me otherwise. Let's talk about it on the air. But what happened is, Hezbollah, of course, is a terrorist organization dedicated to the destruction of the state of Israel. Now, you know, let's recall what that means. Destruction, wiping it off the face of the earth. Hezbollah is funded by Iran and Syria. Iran is dedicated to destroying the state of Israel, wiping it off the map. I assume that means murdering the 5 million people who live in Israel. I assume it means a second Holocaust. I don't know what else it can mean, but whatever it means, they want to fundamentally destroy the state. And so Hezbollah, for a while, there's been peace on the Lebanese border. Remember, Israel, which had been attacked by Lebanon again and again and again, had occupied the land to stop the attacks, and then they pulled out. They pulled out unilaterally. They said, you know what? We've been there a number of years. Let's try peace. Let's give peace a chance. They pulled out of Lebanon entirely. Even the anti-Israel United Nations confirmed that Israel was out of the land. And what did Hezbollah do? Just 2 days ago, they rained missiles into Israeli cities. They kidnapped two Israeli soldiers. They shot at some jeeps across the border into Israel and kidnapped the soldiers and took them back. Well, now they've gone one further. I don't know if you saw in the news today, but they hit the Baha'i Temple, the center of the Baha'i religion in the world, the international center. Do you know who the Baha'i people are? I don't know if you know. They're actually a beautiful people. They're a beautiful religion. This is a religion actually founded out of Shiite Islam, okay? Interesting how religions change. And in the 19th century, about 150 years ago, this was an offshoot. A man, I think his name was Bayhula, something like that. But he separated from Shiite Islam because he wanted peace. He believed in peace, in universal peace, that we should all work together for universal peace. And if you look at the principles of the Baha'i people, they are things like one God, one man, that there should be no difference or discrimination on the basis of man or woman, on the basis of sex, on the basis of race, on the basis of religion. They believe in tolerance toward all. They believe in ending poverty. They believe it actually in one universal language, interestingly enough. But the things they believe in, I think, are hardly controversial. They are things like peace. And what's interesting is that though they were formed in Persia, the country that became Iran, they were persecuted. And they were kicked out of Iran. And they came to the land of Israel, specifically the city of Haifa, a beautiful city, probably the city in Israel where Arabs and Jews best coexist. Jerusalem, they don't do so well. But in Haifa, there are Arabs on the city council and Jews, and there's integration of neighborhoods. It's probably the best example of peaceful coexistence of Arabs and Jews in the state of Israel. And the Baha'i built their temple there, and it's a holy place to all the Baha'i. And I've been there. I've been to Haifa. I've been to this beautiful white temple on a hill standing for peace and its gardens. And the one place in the entire Middle East where the Baha'i are not persecuted, interestingly enough, are in Israel, because Israel doesn't persecute on the basis of religion, and every single other country in the Middle East does. Now, let's exclude Turkey from being in the Middle East, though they have their own Kurdish problems. But let's say every Arab country discriminates on the basis of religion. Israel does not. And the Baha'i moved their temple there. And most people who've been to the state of Israel who've been to Haifa, you can't miss going to the Baha'i temple. Well, today, Hezbollah, run by Lebanon, Syria, and Iran, shot missiles into the grounds of that temple. Hit a symbol of peace. There can be no more definition of war, in my view, than to try to bomb a temple of peace, of a religion that promotes peace. Let there be no doubt. The Palestinians in Gaza, Hezbollah in Lebanon, the people who allow Hezbollah to exist, the Lebanese government, the Syrian government, the Iranian government, do not want peace. Don't let anyone tell you, oh, the Palestinians, they just want peace. That's a load of bull. 77% supported the kidnapping, 16% are against it. So 1 in 6, maybe, supports peace. But these people do not support peace. And when people who want war attack your country and try to wipe it off the face of the earth, you've got to respond. I fully support Israel's strong response. And when we come back, I want to talk about Israel's response to this attack, this act of war, and why I think a very strong response is necessary. And if you agree or disagree, I encourage you to call in. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. We'll be right back after this.
Sweetie, I love you, but those jeans have got to go.
Yeah, I know. Grab me a pair next time you go to the store, would you?
No.
Huh?
I'm not going there anymore. I can't stand it.
What do you mean?
It's just awful, honey. The only smile in that building is that big yellow face. Everybody else looks miserable, and I can't find anything there that's made in our country. That bothers me.
Well, nobody makes clothes in America anymore.
Au contraire, mi amigo. There's a ton of American-made clothing at No Sweat.
Well, where's this No Sweat store? Out at the mall?
No, silly. I found them at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a link there. I already ordered some great workout gear, and I also got you some new jeans. They'll be here in a couple of days. Surprise.
HeadOnRadioNetwork.com?
Uh-huh. Just click on the No Sweat banner. You're right there. Helps union workers and helps support America's other liberal network. Cool, huh?
I knew listening to the horn was a good idea.
Whose idea?
Your idea, dear. All the good ones are.
Union made? No sweat. Great prices? No sweat. Great looks? No sweat. No sweat at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Click the banner. Do the right thing.
This is Bruce Birch, and I'd like to invite you to join me for a brand new show here on the Horn, the Bruce Birch Radio Program. Tune in Monday through Friday, 5 to 7 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
Identify the following water-saving devices around your home. Using water wisely is important since our growing population puts pressure on this limited resource. Ready? That's water-saving device number 19, your outdoor faucet. Check faucets, sprinklers, and hoses for drips or leaks to save water and money. That's your toothbrush, water-saving device number 54. Turn the faucet off while you brush and save up to 25 gallons a month. It's water-saving device number 11, your water bill. If it's unusually high, you could have a leak. Learn to detect and repair leaks by contacting your water provider. Last clue? That's BeWaterSmart.net, a helpful website full of water-saving tips from the Water Conservation Coalition and your local water provider. There are a number of ways to save water, and they all start with you. Water, use it wisely.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. The Bible tells us there's a time for peace and a time for war. For Israel, it is a time for war. Why? Because the attacks in Gaza and Lebanon, to me, show the difference between terrorism and war. These were not acts of terror. They were acts of war. How do you know the difference? How do you know the difference between a terrorist attack, as awful as it is, and an act of war? I consider, by the way, the attacks of September 11th to have been an act of war, as with the attacks on Pearl Harbor. Other attacks I consider to be just terrorist attacks. How do you know the difference? Well, let me tell you how you know. In the words of Mark Levine, here's how you know. Terrorism, and I have this on my website, so, you know, you can keep it down in writing. Terrorism is an attack on a nation by a rogue group, a group despised by the great majority of the population in which it resides. If people come across the Canadian border, as they did, by the way, in 2000, there were two plots. One was to blow up Los Angeles Airport, and I forgot what the other plot was. I know they came down through Washington State and the state of Vermont. And Bill Clinton, under Bill Clinton, the immigration officials caught them, put them in jail. Those were acts of terrorism. There's no question that Canada did not support those attacks. To even suggest it is you know, makes you smile because it's ludicrous. Obviously, Canada did not support bombing the Los Angeles airport. Canada, if they had caught those people, if they were planting a bomb on the border and hadn't yet made it across, or there was a conspiracy involving people in Canada, there's no question Canada would have acted and would have put those people on trial and put them in jail, because Canada does not support terrorism. I know that's obvious. But the reason why it's worth saying is look at what happened in Israel. In Israel, the government of Gaza is run by an organization that believes Israel should not exist, that Israel should just go into the sea, that I guess everyone there should die. Hamas was elected by the Palestinian people. They believe in all-out war. The majority. I realize that maybe one in six actually do support peace, and I respect those, and I feel bad about those. But 77%, we know, according to the latest poll, support war. There wasn't a few Hamas terrorists who attacked Israel. It was the nation, the Palestinian nation, the nation of Gaza, who elected their leadership. Just as, let's recall, Adolf Hitler took power in Germany via an election, folks. An election. He got about 40-some percent of the vote. The Catholic Party, the Zentrum, then threw its support to Hitler because the Catholic Party at that time preferred Hitler over the socialists. Bad mistake, Zentrum, in hindsight. But a majority of the people, the German people, supported Hitler. And he put people in Hitler Youth and so forth. They supported him. When Germany attacked Poland, it was not the Nazi Party attacking Poland. It was the nation of Germany. The great majority of Germans supported Hitler, supported the Nazis, supported the Holocaust. That's an historical fact. People don't like to talk about that now. And please understand, I'm not attacking present-day Germans, okay? No one is to fault. No one is at fault for what their parents did, ever. Obviously. I'm not talking about people who were born after, 1935 or so. I'm talking about the people in charge at the time. Okay. Well, the people in Gaza today support war. And the same is true in Lebanon. Now, the Lebanese government, I admit, is a fairly weak government. They're having trouble. They're having trouble because Syria was occupying Lebanon for all these years. Hezbollah is controlled by Iran. But the Lebanese government has taken a position on Hezbollah. Their position is, quote, "It is not our job to ensure the safety of Israel's northern border," unquote. In other words, while they don't endorse what Hezbollah has done, they ain't going to try to stop it either. It would be like Canada saying, the northern border of the United States, not our problem. If a bunch of Al-Qaeda operatives come in from Canada and bomb the United States, not our problem. Canada would never say that. Lebanon is saying that. Not our problem. Let them attack. Israel properly understands that to be an act of war. That's the difference, my friends, between terrorism and war. War is an attack by a nation against a nation, where an entire nation rises up and commits violence against another nation. When the population of the attacking nation supports the acts of violence, that is not terrorism, my friends. That is war. And it would be wrong and counterproductive for Israel to show restraint. No restraint. And that means Israel should bomb the airport, and they should go farther. They should bomb electrical plants. They should bomb civilian industries. They should destroy civilian infrastructure. No, they shouldn't seek to kill civilians. Of course not. They should go after military installations, but roads can be used to help the military. Ask anyone who's ever fought a war, from the American Revolution on through World War II in Vietnam. So bomb roads, bomb bridges. This is war. And the Lebanese government can stop that war easily. All they have to do is say to Israel, look, that's our country. These are rogues. We don't support them. We will take care of it ourselves. We can work together with you to capture these people who are raining missiles into your peaceful temples in Haifa. We will work together to capture them and put them in jail, put them on trial. Lebanon can disavow Hezbollah, but they won't. Because, heck, Hezbollah is in the Lebanese government. Because, heck, Syria and Iran support Hezbollah, and they control the Lebanese government. And it's not just the government of Lebanon. It's the people, too. In today's Washington Post, they quote two Lebanese men, Hassan Karyani, 21, a butcher from Burj Rahal, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, and in response to the attack, the kidnapping of two Israeli soldiers, he says he's looking down at a destroyed bridge. And instead of saying, you know, maybe they shouldn't have declared war on Israel, his response was, the kidnapping was, quote, like a crown on my head. As soon as I heard the news, I was overjoyed. It was like Italy winning the World Cup. His friend grinned as he looked at the bridge. Quote, if you don't destroy, then you don't build, unquote, he said. Obviously, the destruction of the bridge is not enough. Obviously, the civilians in Lebanon and in Gaza have not suffered enough. They haven't suffered enough that they continue to attack another sovereign nation. They need, and this may get me some angry phone calls, and if so, call in, let's talk it out, but they need to suffer more. They need their electrical plants bombed out so they don't have electricity. They need their roads destroyed. They need to suffer war. Just as the nation that rose up to support Hitler did not run against him until their nation was absolutely destroyed, if that's what it comes to, and I hope it doesn't come to that, my friends, I hope it does not. But you have to convince a warlike people that it is better not to attack another sovereign nation. And we went into Afghanistan and occupied the entire nation and uprooted the Taliban, and I supported that. And if that's what Israel has to do, I support that too. It was very interesting yesterday. Rama was defending the kidnapping of the soldier. He said the soldier was a POW. And we didn't have a lot of time. We ran out at the end. What is a POW? Prisoner of war. Even Rama, who was implicitly defending the Palestinians, admitted, in a roundabout way, that it was an act of war. You can't take a soldier unless you're in a war. And if the Palestinians are admitting, as I think Rama implicitly conceded, that it is an act of war, then Israel has the right to respond in a war-like manner. And that's why yesterday, and I know it was controversial, I brought up the bombing of Dresden. Because who was left in Dresden in 1945? Not those that opposed Germany. They were all in concentration camps. Who was left in Dresden? Nazis and refugees and maybe a few people who were just sitting there scared, but mostly people who supported the regime. And no, it wasn't good that so many civilians died, but you know what? We attacked a military target. That happens in wartime. It was like the dropping of the first atomic bomb. I'm not sure I support the dropping of the second atomic bomb. I don't know that that was necessary. But sometimes in a war, you got to fight back hard to protect yourself from attacks. I think there is a time for war, and I think it's now, and I wish Israel every luck in the world in defending itself. And again, if you disagree with my strong statement, or if you agree, feel free to call in. It's 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Coming up, when we come back from the break, we're going to move on. I want to talk about the fact that Bob Novak has admitted that Karl Rove was a source for him in Tradergate. And hopefully this time we're going to run my interview with the old Speaker of the Texas House, Ben Barnes. But I don't want to stop you from calling in. If you want to call in and talk with me about Israel, I'm happy to have that too. 888-488-MARK. We'll be right back after this.
When Bruce and I filled in for Bob Kincaid, we didn't know what to expect, but we sure didn't expect a call from the decider.
I told Walmart to sell the Easter egg dye kits, you know, the ones with the resurrection egg. We decided they can't do it, that we were going to support Walmart and go with what the Lord told them and buy some of them resurrection egg kits. And, you know, I found the resurrection egg. God spoke to me through that egg. And God told me that I am the fourth member of the Holy Trinity. We're calling it the Holy Quadraphonic. And so now I'm the fourth voice of the Holy Trinity. So now I've got four voices in my head. I have the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost and the decider. I'm the decider. I get to decide.
Don't miss Head On with Bob Kincaid weekdays 7 to 10 p.m. and Fourth Estate Radio with John Fox and Bruce Birch Saturdays 10 p.m. Eastern Time on the Head On Radio Network.
There's a place where a total stranger will give their blood to save your life. There's a place where someone you never knew will save your child from drowning. A place where people will give you food and shelter after a flood. There's a place where, when you need it most, someone will reach out their hand, put it across your shoulder and say, "Everything's going to be okay." That place is called America, where we look out for each other. And it's up to us to keep it that way. When you help the American Red Cross, you help America. Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org today.
Has anyone ever said, "You are the picture of health"? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. If you want to comment on anything that I say on the air, feel free to call in, of course, at 888-488-MARK, or you can write it down. You can go to radioinsidescoop.com and comment on the blog, and sometimes I read your comments on the air. But what if you want to talk behind my back? Did you know that that's an option, too? What if you want to talk amongst yourselves and say, "Mark is full of it," but you don't have the audacity to call in and confront me on air or to write on my website. You know what? You can do that, too. Just log into the Head On Radio Network at headonradionetwork.com. Go into the chat room, and you and others listening can go in and talk about me behind my back, and I assure you I do not read the chat room. I'm too busy doing my show. So just want to let you know that is an option, too, and I hope you use it. And I know I've said some strong things about war. It's very hard to come out in support of war, but sometimes I think it's necessary. You know, at the beginning of the Civil War, and this weekend, in fact, I'm going out to some of the earliest places of the Civil War. I'm going to visit a number. I'm going to go to the Manassas Battlefield and a few other battlefields in Virginia. At the beginning of the Civil War, when the war first started, a lot of the Southern women, and Northern women too, I understood. I don't want to pick on the women, but the men were fighting the war. So, you know, maybe the older men, maybe some of the children. They'd come out and they would sit on the top of hills. And they would watch the battle below, much as you'd watch a sporting event. And they would cheer for their side and so forth and, you know, go Blues, go Grays, even though there was a bloody, deadly war going on below. Because at the beginning, war fever is high. People are excited about war. They can't wait to go and defend the things they want to defend. And so a lot of foolish people, not just women, but a lot of foolish people on both sides, I do know it's true in the South, would come out and watch the war like a sporting event and cheer on the gallantry of their side. Until, at one point, the war got so messy and ugly and deadly that they started to come up on the hillside where the civilians were watching and the women and others had to flee in fear for their lives. Soon after that, as people died, as the bloodiness of war was discovered by them, people didn't go out anymore to watch war as a spectator sport. Well, that, I'm afraid, is what's going to have to happen in the Middle East. Right now in Lebanon, they are handing out sweets. They're handing out candy because they enjoy so much the bombs that are raining down on Israel, on places like the peaceful temple, the Baha'is. And by the way, the Baha'is are persecuted. They're, after India, their largest population is in Iran, where they are mistreated. There's a reason why they're in the land of Israel, because they're trying to escape the Shiites who and other Muslim Arabs who mistreat them so in the Arab countries. And they're handing out sweets. And I think you can discover the difference between a country like Lebanon or Gaza, the Palestinians, when people celebrate the killing or kidnapping of others, and a place like Israel where they understand they have to fight back. They understand they've got to fight back and hit back hard and, yes, attack Hamas and Hezbollah and all the terrorists. But you don't see cheering. You don't see dancing in the streets. You don't see that kind of foolishness. And I think that's the difference between, well, a country that loves war, like the Palestinians and the Lebanese Hezbollah supporters do, and a country that understands that sometimes war is necessary. 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Let's go on to another topic. It's always hard to move from war to another topic that's still very important, but not of the nature of war. But it's right here in our own country, and it relates to treason. Traitorgate. You know the story. It really hardly needs repeating. George Bush wanted to lie to the country and tell the country that Iraq was seeking to obtain nuclear weapons out of Niger. And the facts did not support the lie, so he manipulated the facts to support the evidence and things like the Downing Street memo and so forth. And he's told the lie, and then Ambassador Joe Wilson, an ambassador appointed by Republicans like George Bush Sr. and so forth, came out and said, Mr. President, you're not telling the truth. First he told him informally, then when Bush didn't listen, he came forward in the New York Times. At that point, a smear campaign was set up. And we now know from a small source, the National Journal, kind of a Washington local source. You can see it on my website under comments on the July 9th show, that George Bush himself was behind the smear campaign of Joe Wilson's wife, of Joe Wilson, Ambassador Joe Wilson, and his wife, former CIA agent Valerie Plame Wilson. Actually, she's still a CIA agent, but her cover is blown. Why? Because Robert Novak heard from Karl Rove, the president's turd blossom himself, that's the president's name, not mine, that Joe Wilson's wife worked for the CIA. So Novak has come clean now. Now that the special prosecutor, Peter Fitzgerald, has said, we're not going to indict Karl Rove. Now we have Bob Novak saying, okay, it was Karl Rove that told me. Let's recall the history here. The President of the United States assured us when this first came out that he would fire anyone involved in this. Well, first of all, he needs to fire himself. He needs to resign because he was involved in it, as was Vice President Cheney, up to his eyeballs. But at the very least, he's got to fire Karl Rove, who disclosed the name of a CIA agent to Bob Novak. Now, I happen to think Peter Fitzgerald should prosecute. Maybe Fitzgerald doesn't think he can prove it beyond a reasonable doubt because the jury might believe that Karl Rove forgot. Oops, I named a traitor. I just forgot about it. I name traitors so much, every day, all the time. I commit treason so often that I just happen to forget this particular phone call where I committed treason to Bob Novak. That's Karl Rove's argument. Maybe Fitzgerald buys it. I don't know. I don't really want to attack Fitzgerald. But the point is that at the very least, now that Novak has come clean, it's time for Karl Rove to be fired. Let's recall. The White House specifically told us that Karl Rove and Scooter Libby were not involved in any way, shape, or form. That's what Scott McClellan told us. He said, yeah, I looked them in the eye, they swore to me they weren't involved, and I passed that on to you. A clear lie. Now, why is the press treating Traitorgate with a very quiet, bored yawn? Why is it not important to them that it has now been admitted that the president's chief advisor, under the direction of the president and the vice president, committed treason? Now, maybe the president and the vice president didn't really mean for him to commit treason. They just wanted him to do a smear campaign against a man telling the truth, trying to stop the administration from lying to get us into war. Maybe that's it. Maybe that's only it. And Karl Rove took it upon himself to out the CIA agent, an act which George Bush's father himself has called treasonous. Maybe so. Well, why is this in the back pages of the newspaper? Why is this in the back pages of the newspaper? Why isn't this on page one? I don't know. Maybe it's because we liberals don't control the press. I want to conclude today by playing an interview that I did, a very interesting interview with Bob Barnes, the former Speaker of the Texas House. It's sort of a different topic. He talks about how the Democrats can win back the Reagan Democrats, but it was an interesting interview. And I want to play it for you now.
So the person sitting in front of me, Ben Barnes, is a legend in Texas politics, in national politics. In fact, I thought that I'd had him here on the show before because I'd heard his name so many times. I just realized that's not the case. But I'm very glad to have you now. Welcome
well,
to the Inside Scoop.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for letting me be on the Inside Scoop.
Well, thank you. Look, one of the things that we've most talked about on the show and what you're most famous for, and maybe not in a good way, is helping getting George Bush in the National Guard some, 35 years ago? What were the circumstances of that?
Well, I was Speaker of the House, and it was during the Vietnam War, and of course, the state government controlled the National Guard, and so obviously, as Speaker of the House and as Lieutenant Governor, I had a lot of influence with the National Guard. And I got a call from a family friend of Bush's that was a mutual friend of mine asking me to make a call to get young George in the National Guard. He had used all his exemptions up for college, and he was 19 years old, and that was he was probably going to be on his way to the military in the next 30 days. I made that call, and I also made a call for dozens of other supporters, friends.
And that's the way it was done, in that period of time.
But I said in 2004, when I went public with this, I said that it was really not necessarily so much about Bush as it was about me. I was taking a couple of members of Parliament from England through the Vietnam Memorial 2004 in the spring, and those shadows about 9 o'clock at night were on that wall just right in the light, and I just was kind of overcome with remorse. And I looked at those names, and I thought there I was as a 28-year-old Speaker of the House with that kind of power to exercise life or death. And I wasn't proud of myself. I'm not proud that I got George W. in there, and I'm not proud I got a lot of those other boys in there.
Tell me this. How do you become a 28-year-old Speaker of a House? I mean, you know, because I'm a little bit older than that, and I'd love to run some state government. How do you do that?
Well, I was very fortunate, and I worked hard, but I was a freshman in law school, and I was working at a state health department, and there was some irregularities going on, and I went up to the legislature and talked to my state representative about them, and as a result, a lot of people had resigned from the health department. Well, I'd never been to the Capitol, I'd never planned on running, I'd never thought about getting into politics, but there I was at 21, and I'd gone to the Capitol, and I got the bug. I love that big old granite building that's the Texas Capitol, and so I decided my state representative wasn't going to run for re-election, and so I ran, and no one thought I could win. I was from a town of 2,000 voters, running against a fellow from a town of 25,000 voters, and so I wasn't supposed to win at all, but fortunately I won, and then things, I worked very hard, but then things just began to happen, and I'm probably the luckiest guy that's ever gotten into politics.
Well, you have an amazing story, and I think part of what your story is the change of the Democratic Party in the South. A Texas Democrat in 1970 is very different from a Texas Democrat in 2006, and yet you've remained a Democrat all throughout. I mean, here it seems like the whole party has completely changed. The Republicans embraced the George Wallace strategy of appealing to the segregationists. You stayed a Democrat. Why did you stay a Democrat when so many of your colleagues left the party and went right?
Well, I say in my book, Barn Building, Barn Burning, that when I was 7 years old, my family didn't have any electricity. And I looked up one day, and here was the REA truck, Rural Electric Co-op, coming to bring electricity to our farm. And I think
this would be a New Deal program,
that's right.
I assume.
It was a New Deal program. And when I turned on those lights, and we had electricity, we had a refrigerator, could have cold milk, and changed our whole way of life, what electricity did. I became a Democrat then. I became a great fan of President Roosevelt and what he did for rural America. And I would have probably called my father to turn over in his grave if he'd have known that if I had ever even considered being anything but a Democrat. And so as John Connally was a friend of mine, governor and partner, he switched. Texas switched. Most of my friends. And what happened in Texas is what something that Lyndon Johnson warned me about continually, and also John Connally. They said, you've got to make it socially acceptable to be a Democrat. When it becomes socially unacceptable to become a Democrat, people are not going to go and stay in the Democratic Party. And unfortunately, we saw that happen.
So let me ask you, what do you think the Democrats need to do in the future to reach out to people who are now where you were so many years ago, rural people who need a helping hand from the government, who need to step up, who are being, harmed by the decline of unions and the decline of worker wages? They need democratic health care and education, but I don't know, they have certain values that, how do we get them again?
What we've got to do is we've got to perfect our message. We cannot be just against the Republicans. That's what they expect. They don't expect us to have any new ideas. They expect us, and I'm really talking about Texas now, but I make this application nationally, that we've got to have a message. And we've got to recruit. The Democratic Party, particularly in the South, we lost our farm system. You know, we need people playing a single A ball and double A ball and triple A ball where they come to the majors. And in Texas, the Democratic Party has no farm system. We have no.
So what happened? I mean, you used to be running the Democratic Party in Texas. What happened to the Democratic Party in Texas?
What happened was that Texas is a conservative state, and what happened was our Democrats started moving to the left, and that was all right. But you had to keep ties to the business community, in particular the small business person. And when the small business person thought that we were not their friend, we were not going to do as much for them as the Republican Party was going to do and protect their opportunity to participate in the free enterprise system, but we started losing people. And of course, the Civil Rights Bill, but Johnson told me himself, he said, Ben, this Civil Rights Bill is going to cause the South to be Republican for the next 25 or 30 years.
Johnson said that publicly. Richard Nixon said it. George Wallace said it. And yet most of us, and I don't think even you, would want to go back and undo that.
No, I wouldn't want to undo it at all. And Barbara Jordan was one of my great friends and one of my political allies. And I loved Barbara. No,
so how do we reach past that? How do we reach, I mean, you know, the era of segregation is over. Now, there's still some people that have got some hard feelings. But how do we reach out to rural white voters who, frankly, need government assistance and need a chance to believe in their, what, small business loans? Is that the answer? What's the answer?
They believe that we've got some programs that are good. They want health care.
They want Social Security.
They want Social Security. They don't want their kids to drop out of school. They want the education. They want the kids. They want every rural American today wants their kids to be able to do better than what they did. That's the ambition of all parents. But I tell you what we've not done. We've not made that rural voter and the urban voter and the soccer mom as far as that's concerned. We have let Karl Rove and the Republicans convince the American people that we are soft on national security, that we're not going to take care of them. And they'll trade their Social Security, and they'll trade their small business loans. They'll trade all of that and go vote for another party and vote for another candidate if they think that candidate is going to make them more secure.
Well, let's talk about national security. You probably don't know this about me. I used to work on the committee overseeing Homeland Security. Okay. I used to be a counsel on the Hill. And at that time when I worked there in 2002 and 2003, we Democrats noticed that our ports were not secure. This whole Abu Dhabi incident, this is new to most Americans. We were working on this 4 years ago. The fact that there are nuclear materials being bought and sold in the former Soviet Union. We had a plan to buy up loose nukes. All the Democrats were in support. Bush threatened to veto that bill. We brought out the fact that if you fly on a plane, they may check your shoes, but if somebody mails a package underneath, the whole thing could blow up. We brought out all these dangers to America, and I don't think people even knew we were doing this. How do we get across? I think these are things that people would support if they only knew about it. How do we get across to a rural voter, maybe who has only television is Fox News?
That's right.
The kinds of things that Democrats are proposing to help our national security that the Republicans that are supporting these big businesses have not wanted in the past.
Well, they've drowned our voice out, and unfortunately, you know, if we do a little self-evaluation, we've not had as many good spokespeople talking about these issues as we need.
Bill Clinton's gone. He was kind of our best.
Bill Clinton's gone, and he was the very best. But right now, and this is not being critical of any of my good Democrat friends on the Hill, but we do not have that. Ronald Reagan, America loved him.
Yeah.
Great voice, great actor. He made the same speech.
Reagan and Clinton were of the same cloth.
Clinton was better than Reagan as far as speaking was concerned, because Clinton had 24 speeches. Reagan only had one speech. I heard Reagan speak 7 times. I was a member of the Young Presidents Organization in America, and I heard Reagan speak 7 times. He made exactly the same speech every time. He used the exact same hand gesture. He actually moved his head backwards at exactly the same time.
He's an actor.
As Hollywood scripted. But he was a good communicator.
Well, let me ask you this. John Edwards, a man of the South, is a man who talks about the two Americas, the rich and the poor America. He has the same sort of one speech. I've heard it many times. Can he rise to that, or you don't think he's
no,
got it?
No, I think John Edwards, I'm glad John Edwards is out there talking. I think John Edwards is young. I think he's dynamic. And I think he's going to bring a lot of young people into the party. And I think he's doing a good job. And he also is doing something I think is very intelligent. He's not being introduced as Senator John Edwards. He's being introduced as John Edwards from North Carolina. And I think it's an advantage to be outside of the Beltway. I think that was one of the things that, you know, President Johnson told me when I was looking at running for the Senate in 1970, or waiting to run for governor in 1972. And I didn't run for the Senate, and I talked Lloyd Benson into running because my polls showed that I was 14 points ahead of the Democratic incumbent, but that if he was renominated, that George Senior Bush was going to be elected senator. And so I talked to Lloyd Benson, and Lloyd Benson ran and beat our incumbent senator and beat Bush. But Johnson told me at that time, he said, Jack Kennedy and I had a very tough time getting elected. Everything had to just go perfect for it. And he said, I think if you have hopes and aspirations, and it was all just a lot of political hot air at that time. I mean, Johnson said good things about me. But if you're thinking about a national career, it's better to be a governor than it is to be a senator, because people think senators vote and they think governors govern, even though Texas has a very weak office
of
government.
Right, people never realize that.
American people never realize, and everybody said, oh, George Bush has run Texas. He can run America. He's run this big state. Well, the governor has very little to do with running Texas. But
Mr. Barnes, let me ask you this. Tom DeLay has kind of cleaned the Democrats out of the Texas legislature. He's done an amazing gerrymandered thing, so amazing, and with so much corporate money that he's been indicted for it. But whether or not he goes to jail, the damage is real. The legislature
is
heavily gerrymandered, and of course they gerrymandered Texas seats in the Congress so that those of us that follow federal issue, we've lost 5 seats. And we know that the only way to get it back is to get it back right there at the local level, right there at the legislature level, right there at those few Texas Democrats who escaped to New Mexico and Oklahoma to try to avoid the gerrymandering. What is being done? I don't know what you're doing. I don't know what's going on locally in Texas to reclaim the local Democratic Party that can help us nationally down the way.
What I have been advocating, and we're doing it this time. Matter of fact, we have a fundraiser next Monday night that I'm participating in. We're going back and starting at the state representative and state senator level. We've got 12 House seats in Texas right now that are competitive. We're doing what the people on Capitol Hill are trying to do, the Democrats are trying to take back the House and win those seats back. We're trying to do that in the Texas legislature, and that's the only way to do it. If we're going to ever take back, in the South, people will still vote for a state representative or a state senator, somebody they know, someone that comes and knocks on their door. I'll tell you this story. The only person that Tom DeLay was not able to beat was a man named Rose. He put money in 16 races. And Patrick Rose came to see me when he was a student at Princeton. And he said, I want to run for the legislature. He was 21 then. I said, well, you got to graduate from Princeton. But I said, come back. But he came back and he said, I'm 23. I want to run. And I said, well, I don't know. It's still a tough district. That's a Republican district. I said, but I'll have a fundraiser for you and help you. If you'll do one thing for me, if you'll go run a campaign like I did in 1960, I said I took soil conservation maps that had enlarged photographs of all the neighborhood, all the houses, and I said I took a red pencil, and every time I knocked on the door, I put a red X on it. I said, if you'll promise me you'll knock on every door, then you can beat this Republican. Well, lo and behold, he did that. He knocked on every door. And then in the fall, when Tom DeLay came down and put $300,000 to $350,000 in every one of those races, one man won, last man standing, Patrick Rose, because he had knocked on those doors.
Because he knew those voters.
He knew those voters, and that's what we've got to do. We've got to discourage people from raising the money and getting 60-second spots and 30-second spots and going negative and doing all this. And I think a message that the Democrats can carry that will resonate with the American people today, and I really want you to think about this. I want you to understand much more about it than I do, but I think the number one problem in this country today is not the 130,000 men and women in Iraq, not the energy crisis where we're importing 60% of our energy and our oil, not global warming, though it's a very real and important issue, not the national deficit that's going to burden the next generation. I think the number one problem today in America is the very bitter, divisive, partisan politics. And I think if we can convince the American people that we're going to work to eliminate some of this shoot to kill, Karl Rove's politics.
I'll tell you, Mr. Barnes, I hear what you're saying, but I'm a little skeptical, and I'll tell you why. It seems to me that when the other side doesn't fight, when they hit below the belt, and you don't hit below the belt, you lose. I just look at the last campaign in 2004. You had John Kerry saying, I'm not going to go negative. And George Bush said, I'm going negative. He went negative. And what happened? Polls of the American people said, we're tired of this negative campaigning. And they didn't blame Bush. They blamed both sides.
Yeah.
It seems to me the only way you can do positive campaigning is if both are positive. And that's never going to happen. So I hear what you're saying, but I don't know what we as Democrats can do about
it. Well, I tell you what I think we can do. Look, if they go negative, we got to go negative. And that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that when we do have an opportunity to govern, that we've got to do a better job in them,
okay.
And we've got to reach out for them, and we've got to say, hey, listen, we're trying to solve this Social Security problem. Let's sit down, Democrats and Republicans. Let's be the one to take the lead to bring in a bipartisan attitude on Capitol Hill and in the state legislatures to try to govern, whether we're in the minority or the majority. But I think the American people are sick and tired of Congress. They're sick and tired of voting on gay marriage.
Right.
This, here we are. We got all the problems.
A flag-burning amendment.
I think George Bush went to Iraq for total political reasons today. And let me tell you what. And I think one of the reasons he went, he was very concerned. He got such a black eye over coming out for the constitutional amendment on gay rights, and it only on gay marriage, when it only got didn't get a majority of the
right,
votes,
right.
And so he was very embarrassed. But it was a very good Karl Rove tactic. Boy, divert, raise attention.
Right. It's all about divide and conquer.
Divide and conquer. Hurry to Iraq.
Right.
Bring up a new subject, and I think that's what's happening.
Well, I tell you, I do think you're right. I think actually Bill Clinton showed how you could govern from the middle.
That's right.
And I'm waiting. We Clinton Democrats are waiting. We don't know if Hillary's the one, but we're waiting for the next one who can govern in that kind of Bill Clinton mold and rebuild the Democratic Party. Lots of great insight. We got to end this interview. Thank you so much, though, for coming on the
Inside Scoop. Thank you for having me, and thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Ben Barnes. There's still a lot of wisdom in that old former Texas House Speaker. And I think we do have to capture back those Democrats that he represents. The Clinton Democrats, the middle of the party, you know, we Democrats do have a diverse point of view, but we really need to bond together, and I think Ben Barnes really can show us the way. I hope you enjoyed today's show. Three very different topics, everything from Israel to Tradergate to advice for the future of the Democratic Party. We're going to take a lot of that in the future next week, and the rundown to the election of 2006, November 2006. We're going to talk about the Democratic Party and where it should go and what it should do and what you think it should do, both to take power in November and how to rule afterwards. So hope you'll listen in next week to the Inside Scoop every day, 2 p.m. Eastern Time. And I want to thank the producers for allowing me to run a little bit over today. But that's it for the Inside Scoop today. And tune in next week for more of the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine signing off.